Hi, everybody. I'm Bill McDonald. I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I want to thank Charlie for asking me to share. It's always a privilege and an honor to share at any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially my home group. And I want to say goodnight to Chuck Bernard now, because I know he won't be here at the end of the meeting. And this is far wonderful. If you're new, I'm welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. You never have to drink again, and the choice is yours. But the power is here. If you want to link into it, it's always amazing about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you have somebody's dragging the end of a meat hook, nearly dead from our disease, and 2 weeks later they're complaining about the coffee, If you're not particularly sincere when you're here tonight, I want you to know I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and despite all the evidence that occurred the last time that I drank, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for 14 months, not really believing I was an alcoholic, doing what they asked me to do, taking the steps, but knowing deep down inside that I wasn't an alcoholic. It had to be something worse than that. It had to be something really dark, And it wasn't until I was in the middle of doing my fifth step that all of a sudden I turned into an alcoholic. By today's standards, I was a late start. I didn't start drinking until I was almost 21. I mean, you go to meetings now, you got people taking cakes for 10 years or 18 years old, or slamming battery acid when they're four, I don't have anything particularly against it, I just don't relate to it. I was a junior in college, and I guess you have to do the usual thing. I grew up out in Orange County behind the curtain. And I had this kind of, almost like, looking back at it, it was almost like an idyllic life. I came from my family. It was had this huge Irish family on one side of the family, and this huge German family on the other side of the family. And being Irish and German is a disease all unto itself. Part of you really wants to be efficient in everything that you do, but the other part's a little bit too laid back to get started, I can remember, being kept clean after Mass on Sundays, being thrown in the back of the Buick and driven up to Fountain Valley, and it was called Talbert then, where my dad had grown up, being surrounded by my grandparents and all the uncles and all the aunts, and standing over in the corners looking at them knowing that I had been adopted, having that, Carol talked about it, just not really feeling like I fit, not feeling like I was inside my skin, just always sort of, not being a part of, which I have found to be a hallmark of our disease, for me in any case. I have no one to blame. I look back and, I really tried to find out something. I remember Jim Borghese talking about one time, really feeling like he'd been abused as a child because his father told him to go out and mow the lawn, I look back, my dad was the kind of guy who used to put his sweater on to go out and mow the lawn, he was just a sincere guy, just a regular guy, just a hard-working fella, and he loved his family. The most he probably did was work too hard, trying to provide us with the things that he hadn't grown up with. And I remember, I'd see him down on his knees every morning praying to a God that he believed in, but he wasn't a fanatic about, he was just a war, and my mother was the same thing. Probably the worst thing was that they were just too much in love with each other, totally wrapped up in each other. But we had everything that was, that they could provide. It wasn't a heck of a lot, but at the same time, it was enough, And I have nothing to look at. My father never struck me, Lord knows he had enough reason to, because I didn't realize this until I was an adult, that he'd been raised in an alcoholic family. My grandfather was an alcoholic. But I look back, and all I remember my grandfather to be was this grand old Irishman sitting in this chair talking about how the McDonald's had been kings in Holy Ireland. And if you have a personality like mine, you sort of swell up a little bit, kings, huh? Later on you find out there were 26 kings in Holy and Ancient Ireland, and there are 400 million people on the face of the earth who claim to be Irish, and all of them are related to the kings of Holy Ireland. That's all right. Carol was talking about, my first great escape was books, because I certainly did. I remember when I was I was putting this parochial school, a lady of perpetual revenge out in Artesia, and I was always in a great dilemma to high school PE coaches, because I was always this huge bulk roaming around, you know, with totally no kind of, absolutely no athletic ability, you know, and they would just weep at all the lost potential, I was surrounded by all these other kids, I was a new kid on the block, and I just sort of withdrew. When I was in fifth or sixth grade, you know, they marched all the boys off to Latin classes to become altar boys, and I refused to go. And they said, "Well, you can't do that. No one's ever done that. And no Catholic boy's ever done that before in this school." I said, "Well, I'm considering becoming a communist, and I refuse to go." it starts early. So I was thrown to, they said, "Well, they didn't know what to do with me," so they threw me into the library, which is fine with me. I was happy as hell there, you know, and because books and history became my great escape. You know, in a moment, I can escape into hundreds of years ago. I remember when I got sober, I told Clancy the only people I really respect had been dead for about 300 years, you know. unfortunately, that's pretty much true today. I blundered along, and I can remember experiencing having this underlying anxiety, this terrible anger growing up. And I don't know where that came from. It was just probably that I believe, again, that's part of my disease, you know. And I set goals for myself. I was going to become as powerful as I could get. You know, I was going to get so high that you couldn't reach and you couldn't hurt me anymore. And when I got that high, I was going to squash you like a bug, you know. When I got into my junior year in college, I've basically been a loner. You know, that's not necessarily true, because I had friends growing up, but they were all like I was. You know, we're all just sort of the odd man out, just glaring in from the wings. But when I got into my junior year in college, I fell in with a group of people. We were all, you know, history majors and political science majors and pseudo intellectuals and radicals, you know, and we were sitting in the student lounge wearing our carefully aged new tweed jackets with leather elbow patches, smoking Camel cigarettes and glaring at the long hairs across the room because they didn't have the right dialectic, not that we were quite sure that we knew what it meant. And I had had drinks growing up, you know, but that stuff kicked in for me the first time at Lenin's birthday party on Magnolia in North Long Beach. 1963, I can remember it, you know, right down to the last moment, you know, because I drank that night and all of a sudden I just felt liberated, you know. I turned in, all of a sudden this big fat lump turned into William Powell, you know. I just got so smooth, you know. I just oiled my way across the room and said, "Come on, dear, let's go." And like Carol, I went back to that feeling for years. And within 6 months, alcohol had destroyed my life as I knew it up to that moment. It totally altered my life. Nothing became, power is no longer important to me. I found the secret I've been looking for all of my life. Instant comfort, you know. You know, I remember as a kid watching Spencer Tracy and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that little glimmer he got into his eye every time he thought about going down to the basement and taking a shot of that stuff again, you know, so he could go out and run amok one time more. And I knew that feeling, you know. Within 6 months, I was still hanging around the school. I wasn't going to school anymore. It was more important. It was more important to go across the 49er and get to drink, you know. That was going along fine for a while. And then, it became apparent that I wasn't really being self-supporting. I wasn't being self-supporting. I was being supported by my parents, for Christ's sake. My father had a mean sense of value, so he decided realized I wasn't really doing anything, that it might be a good idea that I get a job. So I got a job in aerospace, which is fine, you know, because their personnel department is much more inefficient than I was drunk. And I did that for a while, and then the Vietnam War was cooking off, and Jack Webb scared me into the Navy. I saw a movie that he did called the DI the night before I got my Selective Service notice in the mail, and I knew I could march to Hanoi all by myself, but I knew I couldn't survive Jack Webb in some Marine Corps boot camp. I said, "Oh no, I'm not going to do that." And I joined the Navy, and I was in the Navy for 4 years, you know, and my drinking was continually getting worse. I became really great at passing out in bus stops in National City down in San Diego, and being picked up by the Shore Patrol and taken back to my ship, you know. And, Never paid any kind of penalty for any kind of my the actions I pulled. And remember, I took my second class test in Japan, and I was in a blackout when I took it. You know, I didn't even go to look at the results of the test that came out. And somebody came and said, "Well, congratulations." And I said, "Well, I don't know how I did that one." You know, and so skating through again. And you know, alcohol from the very beginning began to destroy the relationships in my life. You know, the woman I was in love with at the time, she, you know, performed once too often for her. And then my mother was dying of cancer. She had, you know, had one of these prolonged agonies that went on for 10 years. And while I was in the Navy flew me off my ship so I could be with her when she died. And I came up from San Diego, and it took me 2 days to get to the hospital. You know, it was more important to go to Koku's Polynesian Tiki Hut and talk to all of my friends, you know, than it was. Because alcohol does that. It becomes a priority of your life. It becomes more important than your family. It becomes more important than your job. It becomes more important than anything you love. Because it becomes a focus of my life. I've come to realize that. And it took me a long, long time to realize it and admit it and accept it. You know, that's why I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous today. It's the most important thing in my life. And when I finally got to that hospital, she'd lapsed into a coma after 2 days of begging to see me. And she was in a coma when I got there. And a few years later, after I got out of the Navy, I found my dad had cancer of the pancreas. And 2 weeks after that he was told that he was dying, that came into work, and by this time I'd gone back to work in aerospace, and after a while I started getting 502s. You know, my problem for a long time wasn't alcohol, it was a highway patrol, you know. And I seemed to be hiding behind the right bush at the time, you know. And because I'm the kind of alcoholic, I'm a bar drinker, you know. I love bars. I love, you know, because it's sort of like fantasy rooms, you know. You can just become anything you want to. You walk into the room, you can become a retired Romanian fighter pilot. Of course, you got to get your bars straight, you know. And you get kind of embarrassed if you were quick on your feet. And you get your stories mixed up, you know. And that was a really kind of glib. But I started getting the 502s, and somewhere between one of my midnight dashes between Coco's Polynesian Tiki Hut and El Senor Gordo's Restaurante down the street on Knott Avenue, being around 2 o'clock, you just know she's going to be down there waiting for you. And if that's not, she's not there, she's across town at the Gold Door, you know. And I lost my license for a year after my last, after the third time. The first time I got stopped, it was sort of one thing I learned about alcohol. I drank in blackouts a lot, and you know, I was, well, blackouts until the very last time I drank didn't really bother me too much, you know. And so it's kind of interesting. I looked at sort of proof of Einstein's theory of the space-time continuum. You know, you're sitting in a bar and you just sort of unhitch yourself from the bar, and you're just saying night, and the next thing you know, you're in the shower, taking the next morning. You know, it's just a. You know, one time I came out of a, when I was in the Navy, one time I came out of a blackout and I was on a plane. You know, and it's kind of interesting. You're sitting next to somebody, you look out the plane trying to figure out which way you're going, and you're leaving over. Well, are you going to go to the opera when you're in San Francisco? And they look at you strangely. I'm in L.A.? And, yeah. Oh, well, thank God. One time I remember. The last thing I remember is being pushed out of a car by my father in front of the airport, and the next thing I know, I'm standing in the shower on my ship, which was in Hunter's Point up in San Francisco, which is interesting because you have to take a cab from downtown San Francisco to the base. And I really wasn't interested in finding out what had happened, you know. And but the recollection finally came to me of being thrown out of a gray vehicle in front of a ship and going on the ship, and it was not the it was a ship of the same class as mine. But it wasn't the same ship, so I, you know, the bill was exactly the same, so I knew where I was going. Unfortunately, when I tried to cuddle up into my rack, it was occupied. I was just really annoyed, but I realized I was on the wrong ship, and it was just sort of, you know, so I sort of dashed across the base to get it back onto mine, and I was given a wry look by the officer of the deck because I didn't have my uniform on at the time, I managed to charm my way through. I was in the supply department, so they knew we'd never see any toilet paper again if he screwed with me. And but I've been out of the Navy for about a year, I guess, and I lost my license by this time, and I had figured out that, not that I had a, it wasn't never the alcohol. It was always these feelings. You know, they never understood, you know. Sure, I drink too much. Okay, fine. I go to jail once in a while. Okay, fine. You know, I have this rotten attitude about things. It's all right, you know, but you just don't understand. It's not the bloody booze. You know, it's not that. It's these feelings, you know. And sometimes when I drink, that stuff kicks in, and I'm just, you know, everything's just washed away, and I feel grand. You know, it's not a world of gray, rotten, stinking swine. They turn into human. They just turn, you know, the world becomes warm. I love everybody, you know. When that stuff kicks in, watch out. You know, I'm in a bar, you know. It's just, you know, it's just wonderful, you know. I become grand and pure, you know, all the disappointments and all the anger and all, everything just peels away, and I feel part of it, and just it's just grand. I figured out that not that I had a problem with alcohol, but if I was working nights instead of days, I wouldn't be drinking the same way, which is a totally alcoholic rationalization. And unfortunately, I soon had it figured out that if I was working, getting off my job at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, should not be any real big deal. If I'm drinking at 6, you know, if I'm getting off at 1 in the morning, when you think about it, it's not really any real big deal if I'm drinking at 9 the next morning. And unfortunately, if you're supposed to be on your bus by that time, because I've lost my license, and being Irish and Catholic, by God, you're just totally everything black and white. You follow the rules, and you don't drive without a license. And you know, you're sitting in red wagon looking to eat a pee off for more time, and sometimes you miss a few buses, you know. So I came into work about 4 hours late one night, and I just sat down at my desk, and I got a phone call from my sister that my father had been taken to the hospital and he was dying. So I called the captain to meet at the bar at the corner. He was making double shots of scotch when the cab came in, and he took me up to the hospital. My mother had died 2 years before, and I walked into that room, and he was taking oxygen through a mask, and he looked at me with all the anger and the pain that a father can have for a son that he loves and hates at the same time. He says, "You're drunk again, aren't you?" And I said, no, I just had a couple. Everything's different now. I have it all figured out. I had it all figured out, you know, and I was totally sincere. We're always sincere, you know, when we go through this 5-minute scenario, reformations, you know. You know, I had it all figured out. You know, I was going to go back to school. I was going to become president of the University of California. You know, everything was going to be better. You know, I had it all figured out. Everything, he was going to be happy again. It was just going to be just like it was. You know, but I had to have another drink. You know, and he looked at me and taking wheezing through the oxygen mask. He says, "I don't know what you are. I don't know if you're an alcoholic or what, but you're just peeing your life away. Just go. Just get out of here." And so I went home, and the next morning I was getting up and I was shaving off my beard. And I got a phone call from my sister, and she said that he was dead. And the looks in those eyes was the hardest thing I had to carry into alcoholics. It wasn't until I did my fifth step. My sponsor told me, he said, "You know, if there's a heaven and a hell like your father believed, he knows what you're trying to do today. And that's all a father wants of a son, is to lead a healthy, happy life. And you're doing that today. And just all you can do is make, and if there isn't a heaven and a hell like your father believed, just believe it and live it as if it were." And that was, it probably saved my life from the pain that I suffered from that. And, you know, there was a little money in my father's estate, so I sort of turned into King Farouk of South Orange County for a while. I mean, when I saw a movie called Barfly, I remember, the character would walk into his little sleazy little bar, and people would stand up and cheer, and he was there, you know, and I was sort of like that. You know, I ran into the guy who owned Coco's Polynesian Tiki Hut a couple months after I got sober, and he walked up to me and he said, "Where have you been? We haven't seen you for months." And I said, "Well, Fred, I'm in AA now. I don't drink." And he looked at me and started to cry. You know, I figured I thought he was really happy for me, but I realized it's sort of like taking the Marshall Plan out of Greece, you know. Four or five guys standing like I was in that place, and, you know, really screwed up your cash flow, you know. it just went on. My life just became, you know, just became, my drinking was reduced to the fact that it was, you know, I was terrified of going back to jail again. So I had these little ways of geographically taking charter and how I could get from the bar at night back to my apartment, you know, dashing down alleyways and across streets and over fences so I could get back to my place without being observed by the police. And I always, when I got sober, I thought that, well, you know, I was a bar drinker and didn't drink at home until I remember the time I was dating this girl who managed this beer bar in Long Beach, and I used to help her clean the place up at night, and I Well, she'd be in another part of the bar and throwing cases of long-necked Budweiser out into the alleyway behind the bar. And when I would go and retrieve them after I'd perform for her and doing my duty, you know, and that was an amend all into itself. Anyway, taking these cases of beer back to my place, and then, you know, after a while it became kind of embarrassing having these stacks of empty beer bottles in the back of my apartment. So I didn't want the neighbors to think poorly of me, so I would, in the middle of the night, I would sneak down on trash days and put these cases of beer in front of my neighbor's yard. And, you know, I'd do this about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I remember one afternoon I was walking down the street in front of his house. He's out and talking with one of his neighbors about something. And as I was walking by, I heard him saying, "And that's the son of a bitch who keeps putting cases of beer bottles in my car." My reaction is, what kind of rude are you doing at 3:30 in the morning, watching these people walking down the street? It just went on and on and on. And finally, after I got to the point where I was doing really good at, you know, I was really proud of myself that I'd never missed a Monday at work, you know. Of course, I never had, in the 11 years I was with this company, I never had 30 days back to back without losing some time there, and I was never sick. I remember one time my supervisor came by and asked me, he said, "You know, you've had 5 grandparents die in the last 4 years here." I said, "Well, I give them a very, very large family unit, you know. They're like grandparents." And finally, one time, it was just, I was good one Monday, and I started celebrating the fact on Tuesday, and I woke up the next day, I couldn't find my car. And so I wandered all over Long Beach, where I was living at the time, looking for my car, and I found it parked in my garage, which is a whole new experience. Yeah. And so I stayed good the next day, and I was going out and visit my sister to see how she was doing, you know, out in Orange County. So I got stopped off on the way, and I hadn't had anything to drink for almost 48 hours. I stopped off and had a beer, and got on the freeway and started going into a blackout, which, you know, and I'd rationalize all these blackouts that I've been having for years, but this one got my attention because it was one I kept fading in and out of. You know, I'd be on the freeway, came out of it, flash into this blackout, came out of it sitting in a bar, and flash back into it, and came out of it sitting in a cab, flash back into it, came out of it sitting and talking to Sylvia in the Golden Door, and the oldest go-go girl in America, and flash back into it, and I was sitting in the middle of my sister's front room. She was standing up, looking at me and screaming at me to get out of her house and out of her life, and went back into it, came out across the street helping Mr. Hodge operate his bandsaw, you know, all there. And flashed back into it, and I was standing at the bar in El Señor Gordo's Restaurante, throwing back a glass of a drink of scotch, and I looked down, there was another one in front of me, and Maury, the bartender I've been drinking with for years, was pouring another one. I was laughing. I felt a part of. I loved everybody around me. And I don't know if that moment was a millisecond or an hour. I mean, the next thing I know, I'm in the cul-de-sac 14 miles away in La Puente with 2 blown-out tires in the cul-de-sac. And I called, got the car towed, and went back to the last bar I remember being in because I'd lost my coat or something, and I went back looking for something and had a beer, and about 10 o'clock in the morning, went back into that blackout, came out of it, passed out the bar, Coco's Polynesian Tiki Hut down the road. And I called my sister, and, you know, after my last 502, I had to go, I was sentenced by the court, either go to AA for a year or get some sort of therapy. So, the coincidences that get us here are kind of awe-inspiring sometimes. This friend of mine who was an Episcopal priest had suggested this therapist that in Long Beach, and I had gone to see this guy, and I went and talked to him for once a week for a year about everything from sex to doorknobs, you know, the stuff you talk to therapists about, where you find out what it really means, you know. And he'd sit there and puff out his pipe and look at me with his watery blue eyes, and he'd tell me something nice about Bill. The only thing I came up with was, one time he asked me about my dream. Well, if you're an alcoholic like I am, you come home and then you come to about 4 hours later and start moving again. You do not dream. And So I may have a dream one time, and it gives me being a homosexual, you know. So there's nothing wrong with that, I guess, but it's not my trip. But I mean, if you're ever trying to make up a dream, never talk about walking down a path lined with tall trees. I mean, the sun rising behind them. You know? Anyway, anyway, I hadn't seen this guy for a year. After I got out of probation, I didn't see him for a year. I didn't have to see him anymore. And because I'd sit there and tell him what I was aware of myself. I didn't tell him anything. I didn't lie to the guy. I told him how I felt about things, but I never felt I was getting any answers from him. I knew he didn't care. All he cared about in the 40 minutes was up was for the check, you know. And so anyway, after that last drunk, you know, I knew that the screws were coming down again, and I knew I had to do something because I was terrified that my sister was going to throw me out of her life. She was the only anchor that I had left, really. All the friends, by this time I was this big, fat, sweaty St. Bernard kind of guy, running, romping up your door, with a bottle of wine under his arm, you know, and they sort of push the door closed, and I'd slide down the glass. They'd say, Bill, we love you, but you're just an asshole when you're drunk, you know. I just don't want you trying to pee in a rhododendron or jump somebody's wife again, you know. And, it was just such a sleazy life, just trying to get back to what it was like in 1967, you know. So I went back to see Bob, and I called him up, and I told him, you know, I had this long list of problems. You know, the job is terrible. You know, the relationships are non-existent, you know, and I think I'm going insane. I think I'm suicidal, but I'm terrified to die. And the doctor was, I'm drinking more, you know, and my drinking's out of control. And I went in to see him, and he looked at me, and he says, you want to know what's wrong with you? I said, sure, tell me what it is. Tell me it's something like Clint used to talk about. Tell me it's something you can... You know, tell me it's a tumor or something you can burn out or cut out or, you know, something I can deal with. Don't ask me to tell you what's wrong with me, you know. I have no awareness what's wrong except, with, you know, just the disaster that's my life today. And he pulled out 20 questions, you know. And he asked me, he read me the 20 questions. I sat there, yeah, 16 times. And I probably could have done a couple more, you know, but I thought I should be polite and say no at least once. And they told me, according to this criteria that's set up by this hospital, to identify alcoholism in their patients, you're an alcoholic. And he just lit up like a Christmas tree. Then he shared with me that he'd been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 11 months, and his life had totally changed. I had my first resentment. I wasn't even AA yet. I hadn't seen this guy in over a year. You know, I figured the whole year I'd been seeing him, I figured he owed me about $8,000. He talked about going in to work with his patients and having to haul a quart of vodka with him to work in his briefcase. I really felt euchred, you know. So then he asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting, and I said, sure, because I immediately went to scam. I said, okay, I'll play a little game, you know. I'll show him that Billy's trying to do something for his problem again, you know, just to get the heat off and get things cooled down a little bit so I can start off again. And he and his wife were splitting a pitch up at the Roxbury meeting on Friday night in Beverly Hills, and he said, you know, stay sober. I'm sure I could stay sober, for Christ's sake, you know. It's not the booze. And I drank some beer. That didn't count. And I went to the meeting that night, identified as an alcoholic. I listened to their pitch. I did not identify as a newcomer, the devil. And he introduced me to all the big deals at the meeting. And I remember this one woman came up to me and just sort of slapped me on the shoulder. You know, oh, we're just so glad to see young people get sober. And I smiled politely and said, thank you. Thank you, ma'am. And back in my mind, I was saying, you touch me one more time, I'm going to rip your arm off and beat you to death. And I was walking out, and a big guy came walking in out of the dark. He identified himself as Rex. And he said, you know, I've never seen you here before. I don't know if you're new or not. And he said, I just want you to know I've been coming to meetings in this group since 1946, and I have 15 months of sobriety now. And I spent millions of dollars trying to find happiness in my life, and I've only found it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought he was a real loser. I could think of a lot of neat things I could do with millions of dollars to make it all well, but I thanked him, and his sincerity impressed me. And I bought the book because I'm a brown nose. And I went home that night, and the girl next door was having a party and made the appropriate sound. I scurried next door and got gas to gills one more time. And then the next morning I got up to do the usual ritual, and after throwing up, I was walking back down the hallway. I looked down at the phone. Probably the most important action that I've taken in my life happened. I picked up the phone and called Bob. I told him I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, I was just tired. I was tired of throwing up in the morning. I was tired of burning down kitchens. I was tired of waking up in parked cars with no gas because I managed to get back to my home and throw the car into park and just pass out, let the car rumble along until it was out of gas. And I was, you know, just tired of me having to make the excuses. I was just tired of the sleazy little life that I had. And I told him in real life I went back to meetings even though I drank. I went to my first sober meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Big Book group the following Monday. And went to that meeting, and Chuck Chamberlain was leading the meeting, and Johnny Harris was participating in the meeting, and I just hated it, you know. It was just one of those enthusiastic meeting, you know, and people jumping up and down, screaming and laughing inappropriately, you know. And Chuck Chamberlain said something that just made the hair on the back of my neck go up. And he said, if you're new, we want to give to you, because what we do is for fun and for free. You know, that's what we have to do, is just to give to you for fun and for free. You know, that's how it began for me, you know. And I stayed sober out in the Bob Gunner was my first sponsor. I love that man. He saved my life. And I got involved in meetings out in... Because I know you didn't know you couldn't, you know. I was tired. The longer I was tired, the crazier I was. The longer I was sober, the crazier I became. You know, my life just sort of fell apart around me after, because all the glue was gone. You know, and the stuff that was holding it together just had was gone. The longer part of my life, and I couldn't function. And I was a month sober, and walked through a plate glass door, you know, and walking out of a men's store, and this guy looked at me funny, and I sort of sneered at him like, that's a stupid place for that to be, and just kept walking on, you know. You know, and I was just getting crazier and crazier, and when I was about 9 months sober, my friend Vince, who at that time was sort of the Monty Woolley man who came to dinner character in South Orange County, and had run out of his last sofa to sleep on, and he had turned himself in, and he asked Clancy to sponsor him, and he needed a ride because his car was non-functional. So I went up to the meeting, and the first meeting in the Pacific group I went to was at the men's stag, and I was impressed by that meeting. And that night there was a watch for a guy named Jim Dumas, and I was just impressed the hell out of me that 100 people would get together and sing happy birthday to some guy. And I was impressed by the unity of the meeting. I started coming to meetings with Vince, and I liked the meetings. And I asked my sponsor, I need for some direction. I just felt so lost. And he said to pray about it. You know, and I said, oh, please. You know, and after a couple of weeks, you know, I told him, I said, you know, I kind of like those meetings out there. I think I was going to, one night, I went up to Vince to hear Clancy speak in Laguna Niguel, and I bit the bullet and went up to him asking if I could talk to him. He sort of groaned about another exile from Orange County meetings. And a few days later, I went up to talk to him. And, you know, I told him, I said, you know, I go to meetings and I feel I hear these guys talking about the fact that, you know, they have these lives and then they go over this invisible line drinking and then they find AA after a while and they return to their lives. I said, I have felt weird and apart from and strange and unsuccessful all of my life. And when I drink, I don't feel like that. And he explained to me that was the characteristics of an alcoholic as he understood it. And that if I were indeed like that in life, which he was like, that if I were willing to take certain actions in my life and change certain, and work despite certain attitudes in my life would change. And he reached over and he pointed to the class of 73 picture that he had on the wall, and he pointed out people like Kenny Henderson and Ramon Pena and Clint and Chuck Nisbet, and talked about people who had found success in their lives by taking these actions. And I've been doing that since November of 1974. I've been sober since March 15th of 1974. It's impossible for a person like me. You know, they told me to go find a God when I was doing alcoholic stuff. I knew where God was, and I didn't want anything to do with it, you know, because I knew I was really euchred if I did. And but I go into meetings of alcohol, and I've tried going back to organized religion, and all I wanted to do was be at the beach meeting down at the end of Rose Avenue. I go into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know God exists. You know, I come here every Wednesday, and when I'm pounding on the gavel, I look around me, and I see 800 to 1,000 miracles. You know, and I see people here with true tragedy in their lives and terrible problems in their lives, laughing and scratching like the newest newcomer. You know, and it's impossible to do that. On a daily basis, I get up and do things that are absolutely impossible for the guy who came walking to Alcoholics Anonymous almost 21 years ago. Yeah. I was promised when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that my life would be different, it would change, you know. My life is good today, you know. And it's because of the actions I've taken, the steps that I've taken, and I found a God that I believe in. You know, I know that there's a presence of God in this room. You know, because there's 800 to 1,000 people here tonight who need to be locked up, despite how you feel about being here. You know, that has nothing to do with it. The fact that you are here and sober and not had to drink, you know, is proof enough for me of existence of something greater than myself. You know, my life has changed. It's good today. You know, I have, by the standards that I have set for myself, by your standards, it might not be much, but by mine, it's. I have a happy life today. I have a freedom I've never known, and my life continues to get better. Life is a smorgasbord to me. It allows me to go out and experiment and taste and try anything I want to do, as long as I'm willing to work within the parameters set for me by the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, write a list and put it in an envelope of the things that you want in your first year, and you'll be surprised how short that how much you've shortchanged yourself. When you open that list, I didn't have to do that. All I wanted to do was feel better about myself, you know. And you know, everything has not been. I mean, life has continued the last 21 years. I've been successful. I've been broke. I've been flush. I have been married. I've been divorced. You know, and I've seen success. I've seen failure. But I have lived it. You know, I have lived it, and I've been present for it. And because of that, my life is good today. And I want to thank Charlie again for letting me share.